Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. And we have a treat for you today. We have an interview with Dr. Janice Abrams-Spring, who is the author of probably the best-known and certainly one of the best-selling books on dealing with infidelity. The name of her book is After the Affair. So we've already done the interview, and so we've already heard it, and you get to hear it shortly after our little intro here. This podcast, Couples Therapy in 7 Words, is based on a formula that I actually expand on in my book, Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And if you'd like to help us get the word out about this podcast, please comment on our social media posts and share them and rate us on whatever medium you use to listen to your podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever. There's a zillion of them. And please do spread the word. And in terms of the book itself, also, of course, be delighted if you would read the book and review it on Amazon. Actually does help get the word out there as well. So in a moment, we're going to turn to the interview. What you're going to hear will be Judy introducing our guest, Dr. Spring, and then we'll do the interview and we'll be back after that. So enjoy.
Our guest today is Dr. Janice Abrams-Spring. Dr. Spring is a nationally acclaimed expert on issues of trust, intimacy, and forgiveness. Her first book, After the Affair, Healing the Pain and Rebuilding Trust When a Partner Has Been Unfaithful, has sold more than 600,000 copies, and a new third edition was just released in August 2020. Dr. Spring is also the author of 2 other books, the award-winning How Can I Forgive You? The Courage to Forgive, The Freedom Not to, and Life with Pop, Lessons on Caring for an Aging Parent. In private practice in Westport, Connecticut for 43 years, Dr. Spring is a recipient of the Connecticut Psychological Association's Award for Distinguished Contribution to the Practice of Psychology and a former clinical supervisor in the Department of Psychology at Yale University. Janice, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Janice, your book, After the Affair, has been the go-to book for almost 25 years for couples who are trying to heal from an affair. And now HarperCollins has just published a third edition. What are some of the changes you've seen in how couples deal with affairs over the past quarter century, and what's new in the third edition?
Affairs have changed because people are hooking up online in a way that wasn't imaginable when this book was first published. So I think that's the major difference. And what I try to do in this new third edition is come up with sort of juicy, provocative examples of dilemmas that patients have brought to me that I did not previously address or even consider in previous editions. It's done in sort of a very accessible way. A patient asks me a question and then I simply respond and offer advice. And that's the format of the additional material. I think it's somewhat unusual to have both a private practice and be the author. And I think that's what makes the material rich. When I was first starting, actually, in the 70s, if you can believe it, I flew from Connecticut to Pennsylvania once a week to sit at the heels of Dr. Aaron Beck,
who
at that time had not even written his classic text on the treatment of depression yet. This is how far back it goes. And I think one of the reasons why he invited me into his inner circle was because I had a private practice and I was seeing patients, as well as being very interested in the model he was developing, which is cognitive therapy of depression. And so we would have case discussions and then he went on to write that classic text. Mm-hmm. So I think it is somewhat unusual. Often people either write books or they see patients, but it helps to do both.
You know, it's one of the things I've often commented to Judy, because I'm toward the end of my career. I of course, I'm also in practice, and I've just written a book. And I was realizing I am winding down somewhat in my practice, but I was realizing I didn't want to have written a book and talk about the book or promote the book without continuing to be in practice, because it would feel sort of like I'm missing something really crucial. And so, you know, the idea that and clearly in your book, I think it's one of the things that makes it most accessible. I have to say, we have read the second edition, but haven't had a chance to read the third one yet. So we're kind of wondering, you know, what's new in the third. The stories that you give, clearly out of your own practice, are part of what makes the book so accessible, I think, and so relevant to people, because mm-hmm. you're telling
yeah,
real
people
stories.
People can relate to it, certainly.
Yeah. So I'm curious, and this kind of relates a little bit to the question of what's new. One of the things that you mention in the book is that you don't impose a definition of what an affair is on people. It's really more, it's the couple themselves tends to figure that out, and sometimes that can change. I'm curious, you know, what have you seen changing with respect to that? And how would you answer that question? Like, if somebody says, well, gee, was this an affair or wasn't it? What do you say to them?
So from my point of view, nothing has changed on that. So my definition of an affair is that the violation must be seen through the eyes of the hurt partner, not through the eyes of the offender. In other words, you're not allowed to come up with your own definition. You have to feel it through the heart of your partner. If they would call it an affair, it's an affair. If they feel violated and bruised by what you're doing something wrong. And so it's not theoretical, it's very concrete. And always, as a very simple definition, I say, if your partner were in the room watching, feeling uncomfortable, then you're doing something wrong. And I don't mean that I'm making a moral judgment that it's wrong, or I'm even saying that you've got to abide by them. But I am saying that affairs are about secrets and the violation of trust. Mm-hmm. So if you have a secret, you're doing something where if your partner in the room watching, whether they're watching you on the screen or watching you live, and they're feeling uncomfortable, you're doing something wrong. So always see it through the eyes of your partner.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because, and I think you comment on this in the book, actually, that those situations don't necessarily end the conversation. And if a couple's going to do okay, if a couple's going to heal, what those situations can do is initiate a conversation. So if somebody feels that what they're doing isn't an affair or isn't cheating, isn't a violation, but their partner does, they better talk about it. But often that can lead to a deepening of the relationship, or at least it can lead to better understanding. Sometimes it becomes a deal breaker, of course.
Yeah. But that usually I do call these kind of, these are sound like moral judgments. They're just terms that I've come up with. We've got the hurt partner and we've got the unfaithful partner. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I call them the offender. So it's just to distinguish the two. Usually the offender doesn't have to ask the hurt partner how they would feel. Usually they know how they would feel. They know their partner well enough to know if they were in the room how they would feel. And that's why they keep it a secret, because they know their partner wouldn't be happy about it. Mm-hmm. And they want the freedom to do what they want to do. So, you know, this isn't a mysterious process. Usually that's why people keep it a secret, because they know their partner would object. Yeah. And they don't want to be controlled by that other person.
You know, I've noticed there's two elements to that are tricky. Because indeed, secrets are virtually synonymous, or at least, you know, implicit when somebody's having an affair. If it isn't secret, I suppose it's almost not an affair.
It's not an affair. In my book, it's not an affair. If you go to your partner and you say, look, I have met somebody and I want to have a loving sexual relationship with this person. And I'm telling you straight out, this is what I'm going to be doing. That's not an affair.
Yeah.
Affairs are about secrets and the violation of trust. It's when your partner discovers that you've been doing something secretly, illicitly, behind their back, that they have this traumatic response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, what I find so interesting about the secrecy is there's always the element of, you know, a person just wanting to avoid the nasty reaction, of course. But there's also often an element of altruism in it, even though that's, I don't think it's primary, but there's often an element of altruism. It's like, well, you know, he or she doesn't want to hurt their partner and knows how much pain that will cause. I was sort of noting in the epilogue to, again, we read the second edition. In the epilogue, you discuss that question of should people disclose or not. And, you know, one of the arguments on the side of non-disclosure is the one that says, why should you hurt someone? Just so you'll feel better, why should you hurt your partner with that kind of pain? And of course, yeah. Then there's all kinds
so
of
Bruce,
arguments.
You know, I want to say I disagree with you here. I don't think it's about altruism. And I wouldn't put that face on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that people know when they're doing wrong. People know when they're doing something that will hurt their partner. Mm-hmm. And usually it's a selfish motive. I'm not, again, saying judgments. I'm saying more or less, you know, if you want to be with someone else, then I would suggest go to your partner, tell them straight out, what, I don't love you anymore, or I'm angry at you, or I've met someone else, or I want to experiment, or I am planning to meet this person, and I want to be straight out with you. It's your life, it's your health, it's your body. You know, I'm going to be completely honest with you. That's a loving act.
Oh, absolutely. You know, yeah. You know, no, I agree with that completely.
Has the right to know the truth about what's happening in the relationship.
Yeah.
And when people keep secrets, usually it's not for altruistic purposes.
Well, that's where what I find fascinating is it is not primarily for altruistic purposes. But if you completely deny that aspect of it, then the person, at least what I've found, is the person, you know, if it only becomes that everything the person who deceived their partner did was solely for selfish reasons, it doesn't usually match with their internal read of it. That they can well understand the selfish aspects, and of course their partner can well understand the selfish aspects, but that piece of it that says, well, of course I kept it a secret because I was hoping, you know, I ended the relationship and I was hoping that you'd never find out.
Right,
I think it's a bad idea.
You know, I think any sense of the moral judgment around this isn't that useful. I think that's what you're getting at, and I agree with you. I mean, I think when therapists get into a moral judgment about whether or not you should do this behavior, it's really not helpful to the client.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, looking at simply what are the advantages of doing it this way, what are the disadvantages, so that people, I always say, make a thoughtful, self-interested decision.
Yes, indeed.
You know, just know what you're considering, consider the consequences, and you know, let that guide your decision rather than doing something impulsively and then having to mop up the mess afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. There's a, it's interesting when you talk about moral judgments. I really do try to see people's perspective as much as possible from their perspective. I've had a very small number of occasions over my 25 years plus of private practice where I have declined to help someone with some, you know, project, so to speak, because it's been so contrary to my own moral code. And one of my favorite examples of this is a guy who came to see me because he was very anxious. And of course, I'm happy to help people with anxiety. His anxiety was that every time his girlfriend would go away for the weekend, he would be very, very upset and very worried about what was she going to do. Well, come to find out, yeah, she was going away with her husband while he was at home with his wife, both of whom were being deceived. And I said, gee, I think anxiety in this situation is appropriate. So I'm happy to help you untangle the situation, but I'm not going to help you feel better about doing what you're doing. And you know, that was a choice. That was a moral choice on my part. I just would have felt like I shouldn't be helping someone do that because it just felt like it was wrong.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. It's, at times, what the client is doing violates the therapist's moral judgment or sense of good practice. And, you know, it's something therapists have to be honest about.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about, you know, your third edition being more, that you're seeing more online hookups and things like that. What makes a cyber relationship so seductive?
Well, people don't realize that there's a brain chemistry to this. That when we're looking at our cell phones or the computers and something pops up, mm-hmm. it grabs our attention, and there are the release of these chemicals. There's an excitement, there's a seduction, there's a chemistry to the forbidden nature, but also it's to the what's called the intermittent reinforcement. You look mm-hmm. at the phone, there's no message. You look at the phone, there's no message. You look at the phone, there's a message, pop up, oh. Mm-hmm. You read it, you look at the phone, no message, no message, no message. And this kind of irregular schedule trains the brain to be constantly looking at our cell phones. And I had this experience recently. I went to a meeting of the Connecticut Psychological Association, and they had this fascinating speaker who was talking about her own journey in schizophrenia. And for whatever reason, I found myself looking at the cell phone, popping up, looking at the cell phone. And I missed the point of her talk. And I heard the phone bing, ping, and I realized that I was getting a notice that laundry was being delivered to my house at that very minute. And, you know, the trade-off was I got to read that thing, and I missed the point of her talk. I was so annoyed at myself, but I also understood that my brain had gotten hijacked, and there is something addictive and seductive about that process, and we're just too connected to our phones and to not the phones, the release of chemicals in our brain.
And how does that play out with affairs?
Well, what you know, it's forbidden, mm-hmm. and you never know when you check if you're going to hear something. So it's anything that's secretive and forbidden, and doesn't follow a particular pattern, puts you on an intermittent reinforcement schedule. Mm. So that's why people are going to sleep with their cell phones. They're sleeping with the cell phones so they can hear the ping, so they can get the message.
Mm. I'm always interested in that people will describe, you know, they'll get angry at somebody for texting them in the middle of the night. And I'm sitting there thinking, why would you even know if someone texted you in the middle of the night? It's because you're sleeping with your cell phone, right?
That's right, sleeping with the cell phone. There yeah. we go.
So when you're working with a couple, what is your sense of how people should decide whether to work on healing as a couple or call it quits and heal as individuals? And if they do want to stay together, I know you've talked a lot about forgiveness and have written a whole other book on the subject. How can they forgive each other? How can somebody know when they're ready to forgive or when they're not ready to forgive? I know that's a bunch of big questions there.
Yeah, I do have the How Can I Forgive You book, which is a whole book on the topic. So let me just say that really the process isn't that mysterious. It's very concrete. Often the way I begin is each partner. I work with each partner to make out a hurt list. It's not a list of every hurt, every way that you've hurt me over the course of our lives together, but what I call the mega wounds, and try to give a language to what it is that person needs their partner to understand about how they've hurt them. And it is important to try to give a language to that. It's not just sort of a massive bleeding wound. There are very specific concrete parts to it. For example, it could be you took this person, and this is an example of one of the examples I give in the new section of the third edition. So this woman says to her husband, "You brought the affair person into our home. This is a sacred place for me. So I cannot now go into my home without being triggered of images of you with this other person." Mm. And I resent having my personal space poisoned this way. Mm-hmm. You took this person into our shower, our bathroom and our shower. And now I, again, have these traumatic flashbacks when I'm trying to take a shower. I am angry and resentful over this, over what you've done. You took this person into the children's playroom, our babies where they play.
Yeah.
I cannot hang out, be with my own children in their playroom without visualizing you with this other woman. You don't have the right to do this. You don't have a right to poison my world this way. So that would be an example of being very specific in terms of an objection, in terms of exposing a wound. And then what the unfaithful partner does is I work with them just to do some active listening. It's not, I'm sorry. You know, what's I'm sorry? It is what you need me to understand is, and they feed back what the person has told them. So they get like a 9 out of 10. Absolutely, you're hearing me. Or they'll say, that's not it at all. 2. Now, sometimes the person hears it perfectly. And, you know, the hurt partner says 2. Because when they hear it back, they realize what's missing. They go deeper into the wound. They realize what they didn't say. It makes them clearer. And they're able then to articulate, what is it I need you to understand about how you hurt me? And this process of being accessible, open-hearted, listening without defensiveness, what do you need me to understand about how I hurt you? Trying on the wound as if it were your own. That is critical to the healing process. And if the person isn't willing to do that, then often the hurt partner will say, you're not interested in hearing my pain, the pain you caused me. I'm not interested in forgiving you. Yeah. And I'm not going to heal. And that's simply the way it works. But if they are willing to work together this way, and often the quote unquote offender, unfaithful partner, often they're also hurt. So it's not such a clean division. Often they have been hurt by the hurt partner. They have wounds of their own that they want to share, and has to do with the story as to why they got involved with someone else. Not always, not necessarily, but often the wounds go both ways.
And you find that process, I would just classify what you were describing as intimate conversation, you know, being present with yourself and each other and tolerating the anxiety of that without freaking out. That process of intimate conversation can be really transformative, right? Those are the kinds of things that maybe can heal some of those wounds. And then they could indeed decide to stay together. Or even if they decide to split up, it can be somewhat healing to recognize, wow, I can no longer be a partner with someone who would do that, even though I can even understand it. Sometimes that's where people come out too. But that, you know, that I was thinking as you were describing those, the person saying that, wow, you had the affair partner in our shower and in our bed and in our children's playroom, that what would be required there is some kind of, I was thinking in terms of ceremonies, you know, it's like something in the Torah where you would come in and you would sprinkle the appropriate amount of animal blood in the right places and it would cure it, you know. They need something.
Yeah, an exorcism.
An exorcism, kinds, yeah. You know. They need something that would actually let that heal. And I think intimate conversation often has that effect.
Yeah, I think the idea of listening to my pain, trying it on, demonstrating to me in concrete terms that you get it. I don't think people can skip over that. I think that is just a necessary step. Now, other steps people may say, you know, I want to redecorate the playroom. You know, I want to throw out the bed
or move.
And the furniture.
Or move, yeah.
I want a new house. Yeah. I want a new house. Whatever it is, I don't want to be traumatized when I walk into my own home. Mm-hmm. You know, often the unfaithful partner may experience this as sort of unnecessary or manipulation. Often it's not. It's just not wanting to live with that trauma and wanting a fresh start.
Sure. Well, we do have a listener question for you, so I will turn it over to Judy, who will ask you the question.
Okay, so we have a question from Lester. He writes, I've been married to Winona for 35 years. We're both in our late 50s, and our kids are grown with kids of their own. All in all, we've been pretty happy with each other. We had a crisis about 5 years into the marriage when I got drunk and messed around at a company party with a coworker, but I convinced Winona it didn't mean anything, and we got past that. I haven't strayed since. We've had an okay sex life, though not very often in the past few years, maybe once or twice a month. The other day she came home early from being out with her friends, and she walked in on me while I was masturbating to porn. Well, she hit the ceiling and said I was cheating on her again. Dr. Chalmer, I don't think it was cheating, but she insists it was. Now she won't let me sleep in our bed. She says she doesn't want to split up, but she refuses to speak to me about it unless I get some treatment for what she calls my sex addiction. Was this cheating? Is there something wrong with me? So,
the answer is, you know, he's right and he's wrong. That's the answer. So, you know, in his mind, it's not cheating because it doesn't involve touching another human being. That's his definition. Mm-hmm. She has the definition where when you have sex with me. So the problem is that they haven't discussed their definitions, which is, you know, a problem. So couples have to spell out in no uncertain terms what's kosher and what's not. I mean, people don't tend to discuss it, but you have to. Is it okay for me to masturbate? You know, I want to have sex X times a week. You want to have sex Y times a month. You know, how do we negotiate this? And these aren't meant to be explosive and difficult conversations, but intimate conversations. Mm-hmm. How do we manage our differences? And, you know, that kind of discussion is necessary so that these kinds of misunderstandings don't take place.
Yeah, that would be the sort of couple one might well say, gee, you might want to get yourself to a couples therapist who has some understanding of these kinds of differences and can help facilitate that kind of discussion.
Sure. Or they could do this on their own. I mean, from just taking that example, I mean, most partners find that they do have different sexual levels of desire than their partner. I have a saying. I say nowhere as much as in marriage will you realize you're not one, you're two. Mm-hmm. You're very different in so many ways. And you need to understand those differences and come up with some understanding how you're going to manage them.
Yeah.
So I'll just give one example of the new material, if you don't mind, and we could end with that, but I wanted to...
Oh, not at all. We'd love to hear it.
So what the new material is, people kind of ask me a question and then I provide a response. I tried to come up with some juicy, provocative examples that have come up in the last few years. And so this is kind of, you know, modern day, what's happening. So this is a couple, you know, married 20 years, and so the husband goes to the wife and he says, you know, the neighbors across the street, two women married. And he said, I've been thinking how, you know, they're really attractive and they seem very liberal and very fun. And, you know, I was thinking that it would be invigorating for our sexual life if we maybe paired up with them and had some kind of evening with them. How would you feel about that? And his wife said, I have no interest in that. Thank you very much. So he kept pressuring, you know, that this would be fun. He said it would be good for us. And, you know, it would give a kick to our sex life as well. And I really want you to consider this. Anyway, he kept pressuring her. And finally, she agreed. She said, okay, all right. We'll get together. I'll, you know, discuss it with them. We'll see if they're interested, if they're game. And they approached the couple, and the couple said, yes, that would be fun. That's fine. Why don't you come over, and we'll have some wine and whatever. Well, what happened is turn the clock ahead, and the three women became very good friends. And they decided they didn't need the husband. He was no longer invited. He was kicked out of the party.
There's some poetic justice there, isn't there?
And so the three women continue to have a relationship, both sexual and non-sexual. And he's probably home masturbating. So the moral of the story is, you know, be careful what doors you open. Mm. Think through, I'm not being moralistic about this. Think through the advantages and disadvantages, where it's leading, because it can become a nightmare. What seems like, you know, fun and fantasy in real life can be very painful and divisive in the couple. Mm-hmm. So those are the types of things where people, just new examples with some new material and more modern day kinds of challenges and my thoughts and responses about that.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate your being on our program.
Well, thank you so much.
So I hope you enjoyed our interview with Dr. Spring. And if you have questions that you would like me and Bruce to answer, or some of our guest experts that we have, or if you have suggestions for topics for our show, please email Bruce at brucechalmer.com or visit brucechalmer.com.
And when you visit brucechalmer.com, if you go to the tab that is called Podcast, you will see not only can you listen to all of our podcasts right there, but also you'll see that you can sign up to be a guest on our program, or also, of course, make suggestions for us. And we're very interested in that. And of course, any other feedback that you have, you can do that just by emailing, or you can do that right from my website, brucechalmer.com. So Judy, tell us about some of the upcoming topics we're going to be doing in future episodes.
So we will be talking about why you should or shouldn't get married. There's sex, good sex, and sacred sex. We'll also be doing more shows on how to deal with infidelity. And as we said earlier, other topics, if you suggest them, we will try to accommodate you.
So this podcast is based on the 7-word formula: be kind, don't panic, and have faith, which is kind of the basis for my book, Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And my book is available anywhere books are sold. You can get it from online, from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or of course, any bookstore can get it or order it for you. And we do hope that you will spread the word about this podcast by commenting and rating and liking and sharing our posts on social media. And so, until next time,
be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.